Ladies, gentlemen, and everyone in between. It's the Tom Ragu Sit Down Comedy Show. The place where comedians come to chat about current events, pop culture, and every comedian's favorite subject, themselves. And now, here's your host, Tom Ragu.
Oh, we're on. Hi, everybody. Welcome to episode 3 of the Tom Ragu Sit Down Comedy Show. My name is Tom Ragu, and I'm very, very excited to welcome my guest for this podcast, the hilarious Joan Weisblatt. Welcome, Joan.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
We should be happy. I'm really happy. I'm really happy that you're here because we go way back. First of all, thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Episode 3, and it's been quite a ride. These podcasts have been quite a ride, and I've been really enjoying myself, and I'm very thankful and grateful for everybody who tunes in.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, thank you for coming. Now, you and I go back a little bit, because I was trying to remember exactly how it was that we met, and I think that we met at Helene Angley's shows at Grover's Mill.
That's true, and I think it was most likely in 2011. I started doing comedy at the beginning of 2011, and it was probably 6 months after that that we appeared in Helene's show together and became fast friends.
Right. Yeah. No, I love your comedy, and I just felt a kinship to you from the moment that I saw you, and I just love the Grover's Mill. I love the people there. I love the coffee. And I love, of course, Helene.
Yes.
I adore Helene and Mickey and the whole gang over at Grover's Mill.
What I think is so wonderful about Grover's Mill, aside from the comedy, which is wonderful, is that it's otherwise a little coffee shop in West Windsor, New Jersey. And once the microphone is there and Helene begins and the comedians do their thing, the audience is involved, it's as though we're in a comedy club anywhere.
Right.
It's a terrific atmosphere.
Yeah.
Yes.
I love it. So tell us a little bit about you, because I know that you are a former attorney. Now, do you ever stop being an attorney, or are you always an attorney? Is it like the Marine Corps, once a Marine, always a Marine?
I've been trying very, very hard to get the lawyer out of me, but it's been
and
a little bit...
And some people try to get the lawyer in them, but that's another story for another day.
That's true. I have a lawyer in me, but we won't talk about that. yes, so... It's been difficult. It was a transition, but I think I'm managing. There's certain things about being an attorney that lend themselves to comedy, and other things that make it very, very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, I wasn't afraid to get up in front of people because I was used to doing that, but I was more used to doing, for example, opening statements or taking depositions or doing closing arguments.
Mm-hmm.
And those things are quite rote and don't really, what's the word I'm trying to think of? There isn't all that much interaction because, after all, the jury, for example, is not talking back to you. So you're not feeding off of them. So my early performances, I would say, were much more like depositions. Hello, my name is Joan Weisblatt. Yes, I'm a partner at such and such a law firm. And as time has gone on, I've kind of moved away from that format.
That's hysterical. That's funny. You ever have a bad experience with a jury? As you're saying that, I'm thinking, imagine if the jury did talk back. Like, was there a moment where a jury did not follow the rules?
No.
No. Okay.
Are we done now?
No, but that would be, wouldn't that be hilarious where, you know, where you would have a juror who would either, like, fall asleep or just out and out say, I don't believe a goddamn word that you're saying. I mean...
Well, you know, I could see where you might think that's funny.
No, I would think it would be hilarious.
You were
on the prosecution side?
Well, I was a plaintiff's lawyer. No, I was a defense lawyer. There were plaintiffs on the other side. I did all defense work and almost all asbestos.
Uh-huh.
Which I talk a lot about in my act.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
So now I
talk a lot about Mama Ragu, who I love dearly, and you have the lovable Mama Judy.
I do.
Now, I think, and you and I have talked about this, that the podcast to top all podcasts would be the Mama Judy Mama Ragu show, because they met and they've sat together a couple of times at shows.
Yes.
And they seem to get along.
They do.
And your mom is lovely and talkative. My mother seems that way, but I know my mother, and I know that once she would see cameras and everything else, she would clam up like a clam.
Well, I think we should try it.
We should try it. We should just turn over the podcast one day and just invite them and not tell them that they would be doing the podcast, and then just hand the podcast over to them and watch what happens.
We could do that, and after a few minutes, we would just kick them off.
Right, and then say, well, that didn't work.
Right, exactly.
But I do think that you know, an Italian grandmother and a Jewish grandmother talking about pop culture, movies, what's going on with the world today. You
know, I think it's a great idea.
There's nothing like that going on right now in the world today, in pop culture today. There are no podcasts like that.
Well, you're on the cutting edge, obviously. And yes, for a small fee, I will bring my mother in.
Okay, so what kind of kid were you growing up?
Let's see. Well, I was a very, very obedient child. Mm-hmm. And I was very anxious. I didn't want to get in trouble.
Right.
So except for a few aired episodes of dropping LSD, I was really very, very good.
So did you, were you cognizant of the fact that you wanted to do comedy? So were you a funny kid or class clown?
No, I definitely wasn't a class clown. I was studious, and I did my homework. I was brought up in a house where my father was extremely strict, and my mother was very lenient and forgiving. So, for example, I wasn't allowed to watch TV growing up. My father forbid us from watching television. But my mother, before my father would come home from work, would allow my brother and me to watch television. So she kind of protected us from what would have been a life without the culture of television.
Wow. What was your favorite show growing up?
I loved the Beverly Hillbillies, Petticoat Junction. I'm sure you're very, very familiar with that.
Familiar with the Beverly
this is
Hillbillies.
Way before your time. Right. Yeah, I like The Defenders, which was a show that probably is not unlike some of the criminal shows that are on television now. Mm-hmm. I love Million Dollar Movie. A lot of those movies frighten me, but I still like to watch them.
Right.
So, yeah, Channel 9, Million Dollar Movie, da-da-da-da.
Yeah, no, I'm familiar with it.
You
what
are.
About I Love Lucy? Did you get into Lucy?
Not so much.
Not so much?
No, she wasn't really my thing. I loved The Honeymooners.
Uh-huh.
Yes, I liked Ralph and his wife, whose name escapes me right
now.
Trixie? No, Trixie was the neighbor.
Oh, Ralph and...
Yeah, his wife.
Alice.
Very, very well
done.
To
the moon, Alice.
Yes. No, I like them. I like them both very, very much.
Yeah.
So
we used to watch that growing up also. I mean, I used to watch the repeats growing up.
Oh. Well, I watched the original. I was in the studio audience. So that's the difference
hilarious.
Between me and you.
I always get in trouble like that. So then you ultimately went to law school.
I did. I went to law school. Now, I went to law school probably for all of the wrong reasons.
Uh-huh.
The reason I went to law school is because I was bad in math. In my family, all of my cousins either went to law school or medical school.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have much of a choice because I couldn't do the calculations. So I went to law school.
Mm-hmm.
And that turned out to be a really, really bad idea.
Why do you think that was a bad idea?
Well, I don't think that my personality was such that law school was the best place for me, because law school is very competitive. Lawyers are very competitive, and I don't truly have a competitive nature.
Mm-hmm.
So although I succeeded as a lawyer and I worked for 30 years as a lawyer, I don't really think that was the right thing for me to do.
And what caused you to get into asbestos law?
That was just where I was needed at the time. So I was asked if I knew anything about, you know, white powder, and I told them I knew a lot about it, and they said, well, you know, this was different. But that's how they asked me to do it, and I did it. That's where, you know, I was just happy that they let me stay there for 30 years, and no one ever came in and asked me to leave.
You were at the same firm for 30 years?
My entire career.
Wow. That's very unusual, right?
It makes me such an interesting person.
And so then what caused you to make the transition into comedy from law?
Well, I had been at the law firm for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
I had had enough. I didn't want to practice any longer. And so now I retired, and I had time on my hands. And I've always liked stand-up comedy. I was interested in stand-up comedy, but it never occurred to me that I might be someone who would do stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was just tooling on the internet, and I came across a website. Oh, it was for the Stress Factory in New Brunswick, which is not that far from where I live in New Jersey.
Right.
And I saw that there was a comedy school, and since now I was free to do just about anything I wanted, I said, well, this might be fun. Mm-hmm. And I went to comedy school for 5 weeks, 2 hours a night, and then graduated.
Every night or every week?
Once a week. That
Once
was
week.
It. It was
right.
just about 10 hours of comedy school and then a graduation at the Stress Factory.
Right.
And once I started to get up on stage, I said, this is really, really fun. And since I always liked to write and I always thought I was kind of funny,
mm-hmm.
I put the two together and it was magical for me. My performances weren't magical, mind you, but the idea of doing it was magic to me, and I felt passionate about it in a way that I never did about practicing law.
That's good.
Yeah.
Who were some of your stand-up comedy influences? Because from what you say, so you were a fan of stand-up comedy before you actually even considered perhaps getting into stand-up comedy yourself.
That's true.
Uh-huh.
Probably not the most modern of comedians, but I loved Buddy Hackett. I loved Joan Rivers, Toadie Fields. There are so many old-time... I loved Moms Mabley.
Moms Mabley.
Yes. I used to watch her on the Ed Sullivan Show. Mm-hmm. I know I'm really dating myself because I'm only 30, so it's really hard
right.
to believe I know these things, but I am clairvoyant.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, So I used to watch them on Ed Sullivan, and I loved them. And so that's how I became interested in stand-up.
Yeah. They recently had the Moms Mabley documentary on HBO. I don't know if you saw that.
I haven't seen it yet, but I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, oh, it's something to see. I saw it twice. Really, really, really very, very interesting. Whoopi Goldberg did a very fantastic job directing it and producing it, and it has a lot of this old footage, behind-the-scenes footage, and then footage from the Ed Sullivan Show and all of those appearances.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm really looking forward to
and
seeing
it. And she really
it.
Was the first female stand-up comedian. I mean, Toadie Fields and Phyllis Diller and Joan Rivers, they get a lot of the credit, but they walked on the trail, upon the trail, that Moms Mabley blazed.
I think so, and also Minnie Pearl. I don't know if you know of or know about Minnie Pearl, but she used to appear on stage in a hat with a price tag hanging from it. And she was mm-hmm. also one of the earliest comedians, and I liked her very much, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's how I started. Things have mushroomed. They've just grown tremendously since I started to do comedy. And as I've told you many times, and I'd like your audience to know, too, is that there are some people who have given me opportunities, even as a very, very new comedian, whom I'm completely indebted to and I will never forget. And one of them, Tom, happens to be you. And I'm not just blowing smoke. I mean that seriously, because you saw me perform at Grover's Mill. And then after that, you asked me to be in some of your women's shows,
mm-hmm.
and then other shows that you did. And I've appeared so many times at your show at Greenwich Village Comedy Club, which I adore. And I just... Your faith in me has been extraordinary, and I hope that I'll be able to pay that forward to other new comedians.
Oh, well, I appreciate you saying that. And, you know, I really believe that I It's my responsibility to give back what was so freely given to me. When I first started doing comedy, it's not that long. You know, I can't stand it when people say, when I first started, and it's not even a decade.
Yes.
But those early times, I had opportunities, and I may or may not have been ready, but people gave a chance to me.
Yes.
And, you know, there were times when I fell flat on my face, and I really, really messed up. But I just look at those as mistakes. And for me, a mistake is just an opportunity to learn.
Yes, it's a growing experience.
Yeah, mm-hmm. No, absolutely. Now, you're part of a troupe called Comedians at Law.
I am.
Which I love the concept. Because a lot of people may not know that there are many, many, many people who were formerly or even currently in the legal field, whether they're lawyers or court clerks, or there's even a judge, a former judge, and it was in the news recently, and he had to make a choice.
Vince August, yes.
Right. And so there are many people in the legal field who make the transition into comedy.
Yes.
And so you're part of this group, Comedians at Law.
Yes. In fact, I'll tell you a funny story about it. 6 months after I started as a comedian. Six uh-huh. months later, I was aware that there was a group called Comedians at Law, and I was also aware that they were all men.
A bunch of guys.
Right. And at that time,
which, by the way, the publicity photos have them all barefoot.
They have them without their pants on,
Tom. Pants on. Oh, okay.
If I must. Maybe you should take a better look.
Oh, okay.
Yes, their pants are off.
How did I miss that one?
That's what I'm wondering.
Yeah.
I'm sure you'll be back right after the podcast. But 6 months after I became a comedian, I wrote to them mm-hmm. and said to them, you're lacking a female comedian.
Mm-hmm.
If you're ever considering adding someone to your group, I would certainly fit the bill. I was a lawyer for 30 years, and now I'm a comedian, so please look me up. And I heard absolutely nothing, which was appropriate because I'd only been doing this for 6 months, and where I got the chutzpah to do this, I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
So it's doubly, triply wonderful that 2 years after that, Comedians at Law contacted me and asked me to be part of the group.
That's great. And so you do do shows with them. They have a podcast as well.
They have a podcast,
right,
which I do also. I write a blog for them every Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one just came out today talking about religious symbols during the holiday season.
Right.
And, and we perform all over the place. So it's been a wonderful, wonderful experience. Everyone is a lawyer. No one wants to be a lawyer that's in the group. So although our comedy is very different, we are all very different from each other, we do have this in common. So
right. I find it fascinating. And I find it fascinating that there are so many. I mean, I've met dozens of ex-lawyers or people who were or currently still are in the legal field, and they're comedians or a comedian at night.
Well, the suits are very confining.
Right. Right. No, I agree.
Yes.
Now, last month, Ellen Karras, who was our guest last time, she and I talked about the war on Christmas, or the perceived war on Christmas. And she and I last month talked about that there are lots of lawsuits and legal issues that come up right around this time of year.
Yes.
And so I was wondering, you know, what your thoughts were. Do you think that there is an actual war on Christmas, or is this just something that the media may or may not have made up?
This is so funny that you mentioned this, because this is exactly what I wrote about today on the Comedians at Love blog. My blog post is about this. You know, I really think that it wouldn't be Christmas or Hanukkah or Kwanzaa if we didn't have these arguments. It's just as integral a part of the holiday as potato latkes or the baby Jesus. Basically the same thing. It just wouldn't be the same without it. Mm-hmm. Do you agree?
I do. I mean, I think that it's sort of a modern clash,
or
right, yeah, like a sort of a modern argument. Because I remember growing up, and there not being any sort of argument about whether to say Happy Holidays, and you know, no one got enraged if you said Merry Christmas to them, and they happen not to be Christian. You just said thank you, or you said I'm not Catholic. I'm Jewish, and then whoever it was would say, "Well, happy Hanukkah then," and then that was the end of it. But now there is lawsuits, and atheists are filing lawsuits to have the manger taken out of town square.
Oh,
I think it's hilarious.
I think it's ridiculous.
And what I really think is even more hilarious is how riled up the far right get about the perception of the precious holiday, which now, if you really want to be honest about it, stands for almost nothing anymore.
Because shopping.
It's all shopping.
Yes, it's about
you
shopping.
You want to know who ruined Christmas? Walmart.
Oh, I thought Kmart. Santa Claus. No, it wasn't Santa?
No.
Okay.
Walmart, Kmart, Macy's, JCPenney, Kohl's, they ruined Christmas for everybody. You know, because Black Friday has really taken over the whole Christmas thing.
I know. I was really worried that people were going to run out of my house right after the turkey and before dessert so that they could make it to the stores, but luckily that didn't happen.
That's just a whole...
When I was growing up, I sang, you know, Christ our Savior is born, you know, and with great enthusiasm, even though I was Jewish and am Jewish, but it didn't do anything. I mean, I think I'm taking my pulse. I think I'm fine.
Right.
Nothing happened to me. Nothing. So I think that a big deal is made out of very, very little.
Right. And of course I have that joke that I do all the time around this time of year where it doesn't work the other way around. You know, I talk about my favorite time of year is Christmas because that's when Jews release their Christmas CDs.
Yes.
You know, Kenny G, Neil Diamond, Barbara Streisand. But it really doesn't work the other way around. I mean, you're never going to see Toby Keith singing a dreidel, you know, and so
I'm waiting for that day to come, Tom.
I am waiting for Amy Grant to release her Hanukkah CD.
Oh, well, that will be the day.
I love it. So what was the favorite gig that you've done so far? Now that you're in double digits and everything.
Yeah.
Or triple digits, probably.
Are you talking about my age? What are you talking about?
I'm talking about the amount of shows that you've done.
Oh, the number of shows that I've done. I would say... believe it or not, my last show, and I'm not saying that just because it happened to be my last show, but Comedians at Law performed at the White Plains Performing Arts Center, and there were almost 200 people in the audience, which was wonderful, and we were extremely well received, and the idea of doing this at a theater made it very, very exciting for me.
Yes.
So... ask me again in a year, I'll probably have another favorite, but for right now, that's my favorite one.
That's great. Well, what's your... And you don't have to name names, although I wish you would. What's the worst gig that you've done so far?
Any bar gig has been a disaster. But the worst bar gig that I ever did took place in Parsippany, New Jersey. And I don't want to mention any names, but it was at a tavern in Parsippany, New Jersey. And... there were no people in the audience, but there was a bar, and so I performed to the back, to people's backs. That was basically it. There was no, it was like performing to an owl whose head had turned all the way around and didn't pay any attention. So I did that and got it over with. What about you? Do you mind if I ask you what your worst gig was?
There are two.
Oh, okay.
I mean, if you really want to know.
I do.
Okay. So the first worst gig was at this place on the Lower East Side of the village called Otto's Shrunken Head. Okay. And I'm not sure. I'll name names. I don't care. So we're at Otto's Shrunken Head. And so I'm there and I'm excited and maybe I'm doing comedy like 3 years at that point, and people that I know and are friends with are in the show, and I always like to, and I'm very conscious of this when I am producing my own shows. I like to have people in the show that genuinely like each other because I feel mentally, spiritually, it's going to be a great show because we all like each other.
Yes.
And the audience is able to feel that.
Yes.
So there I am with a bunch of old friends. It's, I think, six or seven of us. And there are two people in the audience. And I'm freaking out because I don't know, are we going to, you know, continue on with the show? I don't know what's going on. And so I asked the producer, are we going to indeed continue on with the show? And yes, the show must go on.
Oh, my God.
And so there we are. And so there's now, at this point, more comedians than there are audience members. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, this is like one of those showbiz moments. You know, I really took this frame of mind, that there is going to come a point where 15 years from now, I'm going to look back at this moment and laugh, right? And so I get up and I do my thing, and then they start, they get the phone out and they start texting. One gets up to go to the bathroom. Now I've lost 50% of the audience. So now I'm dealing with one person and he's on the phone. And that really was just a humiliating experience.
Yes.
The other horrible experience that I had was a show that I, you know, produced. And so I used to do the show. There used to be a show. I think this was before you and I met.
Okay.
We had a show at the Stonewall Inn, the Tom Ragu Comedy Review.
Yes.
And that ran for 5 years. And so I think we were coming back. It was season 2 or season 3. And I had tried to generate a little bit of press for the show. Mm-hmm. And so I had a local cable company come on down. I had a sign release. I had a deal with a publicist and a whole thing.
Yes.
And so the lighting guy and the camera guy and somebody from the network came on down to film the season 2 or season 3 premiere of this show, which was at the time the longest running comedy show at the Stonewall Inn. And we had press releases and everybody. And one person came. My own mother didn't even come. And, you know, she comes to everything.
I know.
My own mother didn't even come to the show.
Oh,
and now
how
it was
embarrassing.
It was humiliating. I was never more humiliated. It was the first warm day of the year after a very long and cold winter. It was, I think, like the first week of May.
Yes.
And I just didn't know what to do because I couldn't back out of it because I had already signed away my life.
Oh, sure.
And I would be in the hole for all that money. And,
right.
And plus I had lighting people and all these people. So we had to go on with the show. And so listen to how smart I was.
All right.
Okay, so... So I get up on stage, and now there's only one person in the audience. I had the comedians fill in the audience chairs.
Yes.
Now, there's still no people in the showroom, but the camera was high enough so that you really wouldn't be able to see the people anyway. So I would just refer to people that didn't exist and that weren't there, and I was like, you know what I mean, sir? And there would be nobody there.
Uh-huh.
And
did you hit a laugh track?
No, the comedians thought it was so hilarious that I was doing this that they were laughing. Now, you know that comedians are the worst audience ever, and they never laugh at anything.
Right.
But they thought that it was hilarious that I was talking to a chair as if it were a person, you know what I mean, like that. And
did you get a good tape?
Yeah, it aired. They edited it down because it was an hour show that they edited. They
yes.
had to edit down to, I think it was 22 minutes or 28 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So my actual set got chopped down to almost nothing, and then there were other people in the show. But
you made lemonade.
I made lemonade, and it was one of those learning moments. But at the time, yeah, I was never more humiliated in such a public way.
Yes.
And so, but one thing that it did teach me, because these are all character building moments, was it taught me to just, if it is indeed a mistake, learn from it,
mm-hmm.
and B, take this moment, understand it, and see what we can do differently.
Yes. Well, I was producing a show for a while in New Jersey, and my biggest fear every week was that no one would come.
Yeah.
And occasionally, my fear came to fruition.
Yeah.
It's very frightening.
No, that was a great place. I played there a couple of times, and it was wonderful. It was a gorgeous place. We won't mention the name because, you know, they, in my opinion, didn't do the right thing. But...
What makes you say that, Tom? Just because I had a show all planned and they had pulled out the sound equipment before I showed up?
Didn't they shut the door? They closed.
Well, they closed for good.
They closed for
good. A few weeks afterward, okay. But they had already pulled out the sound equipment without letting me know, and I had comedians coming from far and wide who did pull it off and did the show without a microphone to an audience. And so everyone was a trooper, but I do have a doll that looks like the guy that owned that place. And occasionally I stick pins in it.
Okay, so there is a part of every podcast where I do a segment called the Donna Summer Video of the Day.
Yes.
Now, I'm Facebook friends with Donna Summer's husband, Bruce.
Yes.
And he's a wonderful guy from Brooklyn. And I wrote to him and asked him if it was okay, as a fan and admirer of Donna Summer's body of work, if it was okay if we went ahead and did a video of the day where we would feature a song or a video that appears on YouTube.
Yes.
And then whoever my guest is, we would talk about the video, the song, disco music, Donna Summer's influence on my life and their life. And surprisingly, he wrote back really quickly and said, sure, that would be wonderful.
That's great.
And so...
What did his lawyer say?
See, now that's the thing. No law. I don't even know if... I mean, I'm sure that he has a lawyer, but he wrote back almost immediately and said, sure, that's no problem. I have no problem with it. That's a great idea.
It's good enough for me.
Good enough for me. So today we're going to see a clip that appears on the Live and More Encore DVD, which was filmed in 1999 here in New York City. And this is a clip of Last Dance. And so we'll play that right now, and then you and I will come back and we'll talk about it.
Okay, one more. Hit it, boys.
Let's dance, let's dance, let's dance, let's dance, let's dance. tonight. Please, mister, can't you see? This is my last chance. Romance. That's right.
It's sort of like, I'm here, I made it, thank you, God.
Thank you so much. Good night, everyone. Thank you so much. Good night, everybody.
Can I just tell you, that song makes me feel so, I just want to do this. I just want to live here for a moment. That song makes me feel so happy.
Good.
Good. You're looking at me good. Now, here's the thing. I don't understand. Now, I know that in the 70s, toward as we approach 1980, there were a lot of people who hated disco. There was the whole disco sucks movement. I don't understand how anyone can listen to that music and not feel happy.
Now that I'm listening to it with you,
yeah,
I like it very much. But it's not that I didn't like it before. It's that I wasn't truly exposed to it. And I think you have to understand that in context. Mm-hmm. I started law school in 1977, and it was like going into hibernation. And only now am I starting to come out of my tree. So I know a lot about the music that went on before I entered law school. But once I went to law school,
right,
it was all over.
Right.
Yes.
Now, for me, I'm, of course, like a Donna Summer. Like, it's at the point where we have to start getting restraining orders and paperwork needs to be filled out because I know every single thing about every single song. And you mentioned 1977. And anytime I hear a year, I automatically, every single time, and I'm not talking about most of the time, I'm talking about every single time, no matter what year it is, I go to the Donna Summer file that exists in my head, the Rolodex, and I talk about what was going on in the Donna Summer career during that year.
She's your Yankees. It sounds right. Like she's your Yankees.
Right. Like, you know how some guys, they can rattle off statistics and figures and whatever, like this player did this and, you
yes,
know,
my
this
husband
is his
does
average.
That. That's normally when I go to sleep.
Right. Which I find tremendously unattractive. You ever meet a gay man who can do that?
No.
Yeah, I call them strays. They're the straight gays. They are an anomaly. It's so foreign to me. Like, I am able to rattle off Broadway shows, and I know about the theater, and I know, who is in the upcoming season of Carmen and
yes,
things like that. And I also know Donna Summer, Disco, Sister Sledge, Chic, Blondie, Cher. I mean, I have a repertoire. But
that's impressive.
Donna Summer is the all-time favorite. So you mentioned 1977, and that, of course, was the year that I Feel Love came out. Anyway, this song was 1978.
Yes.
Originally.
I was already sleeping.
Right. So you were already in law school.
Correct.
Right. And so that was from originally, the original version of that song was the soundtrack, Thank God It's Friday. And her character in the movie was named Nicole. And she was a struggling disco singer trying to get her song out in the clubs. And this was the song. And it was like a major hit in the movie. It won the Academy Award for best song in a movie.
Wow.
And it sort of went on to be her signature song. I think that of all the songs, you know, there's Bad Girls and there's Hot Stuff, but there's a real showstopper at all of the Donna Summer concerts that I've gone to. And I think that I've seen her live about 8 times in my lifetime. It was the encore. It was the one where you knew that this was the last moment. There wasn't going to be anything after this.
Yes.
And that was from the 1999 VH1 special Live and More Encore, which I had the pleasure of being in the
you
audience.
You attended that?
I attended that. I was in the audience. I was really, really in the back. But I was at the Hammerstein Ballroom in February 1999. And seeing that special and how it was edited and the lighting and everything, it was just an amazing thing of beauty.
Did she acknowledge you?
I wasn't famous at the time,
no, okay.
Like I am now. I didn't have my podcast where tens of people were watching.
Right.
I mean, it was.
If then were now, it would be a different story.
Right. Yeah. So do you have a special disco memory or a Donna Summer memory, a moment?
No.
No. Ladies and gentlemen, I have met the unicorn right here. I've met the person that has no frame of reference for any Donna Summer anything.
None.
Thanks for sharing.
But that doesn't mean that I didn't enjoy watching this particular clip. In fact, I enjoyed it tremendously.
Well, isn't it just enjoyable? How can you not be happy?
Well, there are things about it that I guess I'm kind of analytical by profession and by nature. Mm-hmm. May we talk a little bit about the clip?
Sure. Let's talk about the clip.
Okay.
Of course.
I thought that she displayed an elegance in the clip that is so rare to see. Her dress was beautiful. Mm-hmm. Now, did she have costume changes through the show?
There were costume changes, and there was one where it was a detachable. There were straps, and then there were detachable straps, and then suddenly it was a ball gown.
But no meat or anything like that? She wasn't wearing steaks or anything like that?
She was not twerking.
No twerking.
There was no twerking going on, okay. Even though her husband was in the band. And she could have.
Yes.
Because they were married.
No, I understand. I understand. But her presentation spoke for itself. Her voice was so beautiful that she could have been, I was going to say stark naked, but that would have brought up a whole different set of issues. But she could have been wearing a sheet, and it wouldn't have meant her voice was magnificent.
Right.
Yes.
And can I tell you, of all of the live performances that I've attended and the live performances that I've seen on YouTube and other places, never, not once, a bad note. Not one bad note.
Mm-hmm.
The voice was always perfect. It was just it was literally a gift. I mean, I just think that there are some people who are gifted.
Yes.
And this is what they were meant to do. And she was meant to sing. She had a voice like an angel, like anything, like nothing that I have ever seen.
And I didn't know that about, I knew nothing about Donna. I mean, I know the song. I've heard the song before, but I didn't know that about her. I didn't realize that she had such a magnificent voice with tremendous range and clarity and sweetness. Beautiful.
I recommend you looking up the whole entire concert, the TV special, because VH1, I think it was in the year 2000, did a one-hour TV special.
Okay.
And which was the taping that I went to, but the DVD is even longer and contains more things. And she goes from disco to gospel to country to Last Dance and everything in between. You know, it spanned her whole entire career. It is such a journey that you go on.
Yes.
It was. It really was something to see.
Well, now that I'm retired and out of hibernation, I think I can probably accomplish that.
Go get it. It's on Amazon. Shit. All right. So, so I thought that since you are a lawyer, and I don't think that you ever stop becoming a lawyer. I mean, you're a stand-up comedian and you're very, very funny. But I think that, you know, there's a little bit of law that exists in there.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. No matter how I've tried to extract it, it's
right.
still present.
No, right. Once it's in, it's in. And so I thought that we would talk about some legal cases that were in the news that I find to be not only some of them hilarious, but also significant.
Okay.
Okay, so the first thing I happen to think, you know, which is for me the story of the year, and it is the gift that keeps on giving, and that is the cracked out mayor of Toronto, Rob Ford.
Oh, my favorite mayor.
I love him.
I do too.
Okay. So go.
Yeah.
Rob
Ford. First of all, what I think is hysterical is that no matter what he does, and he's done incredibly outrageous things, mm-hmm. there is no provision to get rid of this guy. The city council does not have the power to remove him from office. So they've basically stripped him, they've taken off everything except for his clothes. He has zero power, mm-hmm. and he is still the mayor of Toronto. Is that not amazing?
They stripped him of his power, and what did he do? The next day he went on and got a reality TV program with his equally unattractive brother.
Yes.
Right? I have no evidence that his brother is also on crack, but it is a rumor, and so that's good enough for me. But I just am saying that the two of them went on the next day, after he was stripped of his power.
Yes.
They went on and did a television program, sort of an interview type of television program. Did you see it?
No, I didn't.
There were lots of graphics and everything was going on.
Was it like a comedy routine?
It could have been a comedy routine, but he was very serious. And his brother, whose name might be Dan.
Yes.
And Dan would ask him questions. So what do you think about this one? And what do you think about that one? And then Rob.
You're on a first-name basis,
Rob,
with the mayor of Toronto.
Right.
Yes?
We're going on a rant, a sweaty, crack-fueled rant about what he thought about this one and what he thought about that one. For me, I have to tell you that this is the story that just keeps on giving.
And it's comedy gold.
No end. It's more than comedy gold. It's comedy herpes, is what I'm saying. Because it's the gift that keeps on giving. And just when you think that it's done and you're not going to have another breakout, then bang, there it goes again.
Well, the latest news about him I saw was that he may have tried to pay someone off in order that his tape showing him smoking crack would not be turned over. I think he offered $5,000 plus a car to a Somali who was recorded on a police wiretap. Two Somalis were having a conversation in Somalian, if that's what they speak there, and it had to be translated. I hope the translation was accurate, but one of the Somalis talked about how Rob Ford had offered him a car and $5,000 not to turn the tape over, but I guess that never happened.
I don't think that the translation was exactly right, because it wasn't a car that Rob offered to give him. I'm just saying that may have been something else.
Yes, and speaking of that, you know, he did brag about his wife's talent in that particular area, which right. I was very impressed with.
Right.
I wonder how she felt about that.
Yeah, I venture to guess that she was probably humiliated.
But
it wouldn't be the first time that she would be humiliated about her husband. And her husband is now known as the cracked-out mayor of Toronto. Even when they introduce him on the news programs, they refer to him as Rob Ford, the crack-addicted mayor of Toronto. I mean, that's his title now.
It
would even be on the bottom. Like, if it were a thing on the TV show, it would say, Rob Ford, crack-addicted.
Yes.
Da-da-da-da-da. Anyway.
Yes. It's very much like Manuel Noriega, the strong man. He's the crack-addicted mayor. Yes.
So, recently, Hawaii became the latest state to make to legalize gay marriage in the United States. And yes, Hawaii is a state, ladies and gentlemen. So it is now the, I think, 16th state, including the District of Columbia in this country, where gay marriage is legal, joining New York, New Jersey, Rhode Island, Delaware, Massachusetts, et cetera.
Yes.
So from your legal perspective, What are your thoughts?
My thoughts are that Hawaii is a great place to get married because of all the flowers and the colorful outfits. And I mean, it would be like a gay pride parade in Hawaii. Right. And I think it's a wonderful thing. I believe in the institution of marriage. I believe in it for everybody. And if you are, you know, silly enough to get married, then, you know, it's fine with me.
Right.
Do you see yourself, if you met the right person, do you see yourself getting married?
If I met the right person, but I am impossible. I am an impossible person to get along with. So I don't ever see myself getting married.
Right. We get along really well, but I doubt that we'll ever get married.
Yeah. I mean, living with me is something else. I mean, I'm impossible. I mean, I might be a good cook, and I may be able to make people laugh, but living with me is a whole different thing. So I really don't see myself getting married or even being in a long-term relationship. I tried it a few times, and it just didn't work.
Okay.
And so I've learned that this is not for me.
It's not for everybody.
You know, I'll have a dog, you know, and I will take care of a dog. You know, I'm raising Pete Ragu.
Yes.
Right, and he's a handful.
Mm-hmm.
And
is he an adolescent now? Is he in his adolescence?
He is. He's actually middle-aged. He's approaching middle age. He is 6, so he'll be 7.
Oh.
In 2014, he'll be 7 years old.
Okay.
That's.
Is he losing his hair or?
It's turning gray.
It is.
It is
getting a little
gray.
Stooped.
No, he still runs around like he's a puppy. It's unbelievable.
That's good. He's got a good drive.
Yeah.
Good.
It's all the energy and the food that.
I never had a pet.
No, never had pets.
Well, I did. I had a hamster, and I had a turtle, but my turtle wouldn't kiss me. I really wanted to kiss my turtle. It wouldn't kiss back.
Right.
But I know I've never had anything more than that.
You know, despite popular belief, they don't turn into Prince Charming when you kiss them.
They don't.
No.
Well.
So I saved you that trouble.
I appreciate that.
So let's talk about Amanda Knox, because this story fascinated me. For years it fascinates me. Because, of course, we know that the whole trial took place in Italy. The alleged, a crime did happen, but we don't think in this country that she is the proper person. They put her on trial they put the wrong person on trial.
That may very well be. There was a lack of evidence.
Right.
Although she was convicted the first time that they.
Right.
When she was tried, she was convicted.
Right. So do you think that if this case were to not be tried in Italy, but to be tried here in the States, that it wouldn't even have made it to trial?
Well, I think she would have been. If she were tried, are you saying if this set of circumstances happened in the United States?
Mm-hmm.
Well, she probably would never have been arrested. She probably would never have been arraigned. She probably never would have been tried. But it wasn't tried here. They have a different form of government. They have different rules. And obviously, it doesn't work the same way as it works here. So my feeling is if she had been tried here, she would have been acquitted. Now, if she had been tried here and she were acquitted, there would have double jeopardy would have attached. She would never be allowed to be tried again. So the question is now, what is going to happen in Italy? As you know, she was found guilty in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
The appeals court threw it out for a lack of evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And now the appeals court is trying it in absentia. She's not there.
Right.
And she could be convicted again. The question is, will she be extradited from the United States to Italy if she is found guilty, or will double jeopardy have attached? And it's an uncertain legal question. We don't really know the answer to it. I cannot believe in a million years that she will be extradited to Italy. It's just not going to happen.
Right. But she can never travel, because if she goes to a place to a country where they do have that relationship with Italy, she could then be extradited to Italy.
Right. Well, if she has to stay in the United States for the rest of her life, well, that's the way it goes. It's not so bad here.
Right. There are some people that never leave.
Right. I mean, we do have the Grand Canyon and the Space Needle in Seattle.
Right. It's great.
It is. It is.
No, there are some great parts of this country. There are some great parts of New Jersey.
There are?
Yeah. And New York. New York State is gorgeous.
It is. And there are wonderful parts of New Jersey. Yes.
Right.
Yeah. But when you tell me, when you find out what they are, I hope that you'll fill me in.
So let's talk about three of my favorite people that right now. So we have Alec Baldwin.
Yes.
We have Martin Bashir.
Yes.
And then we have Lara Logan of 60 Minutes.
Yes.
Now, all of these people were not mutually exclusive, and then suddenly everything they all join together at one point.
Yes.
Okay. Now, Lara Logan has been a correspondent on 60 Minutes for at least a couple of years now.
Right.
And she had that story where she interviewed the guy who ended up lying about a lot of what happened in Benghazi.
Correct.
Martin Bashir, I can't stand Martin Bashir, not for what he said about Sarah Palin,
yes,
but what he has continued to do with the whole Michael Jackson thing. He was very outspoken. I believe he tricked Michael Jackson and you know, lied and said certain things and then just completely did a 180 and produced this horrible, horrible Michael Jackson documentary that infuriated the Jackson family.
I saw that.
Yeah, and it was really, really a dirty trick.
But obviously that didn't stand in...
No, he still
the way of him getting his own TV show, which he had.
Right, and he has had many TV shows since then.
Yes,
but this is a relatively new TV show, maybe a year that he's been on. Or he had been on MSNBC.
Yes,
and he had said some really vile things about Sarah Palin, which, you know, it's his right to have a certain feeling, but he just went about it, I believe, in a very low-class way. I mean, I just wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't have said what he said. I don't like Sarah Palin.
Yes.
I think that, you know, she should find other work. You know, I think that anybody who quits their job when the people of a state have elected you,
yes,
and then you quit your job to write books and get reality television programs, mm-hmm, I think that says a lot about your character.
Yes.
So, and that's what I feel about her. Now, and then there is, of course, Alec Baldwin, who felt nothing. Okay, kids, if you know, cover your ears, because he called photographers a cocksucking faggot.
Maybe a cocksucking fathead. Isn't that an expression people use?
Right. People say that all the time, don't they? And then he also said, it was either fathead or maggot. I may have said maggot. Because you know how you're always calling cocksuckers maggots?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Maggots are fatheads. But, you know, faggot I've never heard.
Right. Yeah, that would never leave his mouth.
No.
So these three stories were completely separate. And then all of a sudden, everyone got fired.
Right. Well, what makes his story a little bit different from their stories is that what makes his different from the others, I sound like Sesame Street, what makes this different from the others, is that he did not make his comments on air.
Right.
So the question is whether or not his private behavior, although in public but not in the context of his job, should have cost him his job. And I'm not saying yes or no at this point. I'm just saying that that makes it a little bit different from the other two situations.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree?
I do agree. I think that and you know, you know about these moral clauses that exist in these contracts.
Yes.
And that a lot of what you do, whether it is on the air or off the air, what you do in your life, these moral clauses dictate what is allowable.
Absolutely.
Right?
Just like as a lawyer, I always have to keep in mind that I'm an officer of the court, so mm-hmm, that my behavior has to be exemplary, except when I'm on stage, which is a completely different mm-hmm thing.
Right. So.
But you're right, because they have sponsors that they have to answer to, and they have an audience, and obviously their employers are looking at the bottom line.
Right, of course.
Right.
Now, Alec Baldwin has a long-standing history of being pro-gay, pro-gay rights, pro-gay marriage. And so this came as a very big surprise, and he's done a lot of work for GLAAD.
Yes.
Which is the Anti-Defamation League for the gays and lesbians. And so it came as a very big surprise to those of us in the community that this is what he actually said. And so do you think that that the gay community should give someone like Alec Baldwin, who has a demonstrated history of being a friend of the community, a break?
A pass.
Well,
as a heterosexual, I'm not sure that I'm in a position to say. I think that if it were all right with gay people, I guess it would be all right. But then again, I find that language so reprehensible. But here's, you know, a person who also called his daughter a pig. So he definitely has a side to him which is volatile and unpredictable. Mm-hmm. And although he hasn't said these types of things on the air, I guess as an employer, I might think, you know, he's capable of saying these things off the air. What is he capable of saying on the air? It would make him a question mark. But back to your comment, I think if you said to me, as a gay man, if you said to me, it's okay with me and with my community for him to be on the air, I would not argue with you. What's your position?
I'm actually torn, you know, in his particular case, because he has been such a friend to the gay community. It came as a complete shock. And I actually was hoping that he was misquoted. But it's so unlikely that he called somebody a fathead.
Well, he said, see effing fathead.
Right.
So there's really
I'm very torn, because on one hand, language like that, when you're using those sort of slurs about people, it's unacceptable. But you have to understand. But also, I also understand that being a person in the public eye and the paparazzi are waiting for you outside of your building.
Yes.
And they do not leave those people alone for a minute. And sometimes you just get tired of it.
I agree. But someone like Brad Pitt, for example, who has paparazzi in his face all the time, mm-hmm. doesn't make statements like that.
Yeah.
And the problem is that if he is given a pass, then what happens the next time that some other person says something equally offensive? Does that person get a pass too? How do we do it on a case-by-case basis? I almost feel as though it waters down the position of the gay community if the gay community were to give him a pass.
Mm-hmm.
Because that kind of language is not acceptable.
Right.
It's not acceptable on the air. It's not acceptable off the air.
Yeah.
And hope that he continues. You know, he can still continue with his pro-gay activities or activities that are helpful to the gay community. If he feels that way, he can still continue. But you know, I'm not so sure that he should be given a pass. I feel torn. I feel torn the way you do.
No, I actually feel torn. I was very, very surprised, because I do know of his tremendous history.
Yes.
And everything. So there is this case, the Supreme Court case that's and it always fascinates me what makes up to the Supreme Court and what doesn't.
Yes.
But there's this case that's going to be heard at the Supreme Court, which poses the question, do corporations have the same religious freedom religious freedom rights as people do?
Right.
And so in other words, you know, it raises the corporations are people, my friend, point.
Yes.
That Mitt Romney raised during the election. So are corporations like people?
Well, the Supreme Court basically said that they are people in the United, the Citizens United decision, which had to do with the super PACs and whether or not super PACs could give unrestricted amounts of money to political campaigns.
Right.
And so the way that the decision was written in the majority, it did basically equate corporations with people, and that corporations have free speech rights the way people have free speech rights. But, you know, I think that that's hooey.
Mm.
You like that, hooey?
That legal term?
Yes, that's a term of art. I think that that's hooey, and then you take it farther and farther, and it's a slippery slope. So no, I don't think corporations are people. I don't think that they should be people for legal purposes. And so I don't like the direction that the Supreme Court is going when it comes to characterizing corporations as people.
Right. I was listening to somebody, and they were saying that you know, using contraception interrupts the natural order of things. And I thought that this was a ridiculous argument, because there are so many things that we as human beings in a modern society do to interrupt the natural order of things. I know many people, myself included, dye their hair.
Yes.
That's interrupting the natural order of things. So are we now going to have laws precluding people from dyeing their hair?
Well, I certainly hope not.
gaining weight. If you gain too much weight and, are you interrupting the natural order of things? And then if you go ahead and lose that weight, you know, when does that weight become natural? And now you are naturally overweight. Now if you go and you start to lose weight and you go to the gym and you work out like a demon and now you lose a tremendous amount of weight in a short period of time, and therefore interrupting the natural order of things.
Right.
Is that going to become illegal? The adoption of babies, if one cannot conceive, I would consider that to be against the natural order of things.
Right. You're making what I would think is a libertarian point of view, and I can understand where you're coming from, but I don't think anyone is going to stop you from dyeing your hair. Right. So I think you needn't be concerned about that.
Thank goodness.
Yes.
Although I really have tried to stop. I mean, I'm trying to cut down on the dyeing. I'm letting it all grow out. Can you
Why?
See that? I don't know. I just think, you know.
Don't you think that gray hair makes a person look older?
I do think that gray hair makes a person look older, but I also do recognize that it's becoming a weekly thing for me.
Ah.
Because it grows back so quickly between the beard. Because it's not just the hair.
Oh.
It's the beard. It's the mustache. It's the side. It's the around the temples. It's everything.
Yes.
If it was just, you know, the hair, I would be able to do it, you know, once every 3 weeks, and then that would be fine.
Okay.
But I would find that I would have to do the whole thing before a show. It became a whole glockenschlockel.
It's a lot of maintenance.
A lot of maintenance, and I just
right, because I can go for 6 weeks without dyeing my hair, so I don't find it oppressive, but I understand how you feel.
Yeah.
I feel your pain.
To use a sophisticated legal term, it's a fucking pain in the ass. All right. So every podcast, I like to turn the reins over to my guest.
Yes.
And I have no knowledge of what you are going to talk about. So, Joan Weisblatt, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about how comedians deal with either family members or close friends that have no interest in coming to see them perform or reading their podcasts. And you see, I bring this up because I have a family member, and I'm not going to mention who that is, but it's not my mother or my father. It's not my husband. It's not my children. And I don't have any sisters. So this family member, and I only have one of this type of family member, is very, very good to me.
Hmm.
And in very, very important ways. And yet this family member does not seem to have any interest in seeing me perform or in reading my blogs. And in fact, I said, but I'm your, you know, I'm related to you in this particular way. And
we grew up together.
Right, right. And the response I got was, I don't read on demand. So that was a little bit hurtful.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess what I want to talk about is, what do you think the expectations are that a comedian or any artist should have of someone who is close to them, who refuses to either come to a performance or to read what they write?
Well, I mean, this actually happened, you know, and I used guilt, you know. Mm-hmm. So my best friend, in the beginning, when I was doing comedy, he would come to a lot of the shows, and he was there all the time. And then he sort of like dropped off, and he just stopped coming.
Uh-huh.
And I understand that it was. You've seen it. You've seen me perform. You've seen my show. You know, this is not exactly the same thing that's going on with you and allegedly your brother. But
I didn't say it was my brother.
Okay. But the thing is that I used guilt in this instance with my close friend. And I said, you know, the least that you could do is be supportive. And I've come to all of your things, and I don't understand. And so he came for a few more times, and then it wasn't something that he wanted to continue doing. This is what I think. I think that you're either going to have somebody who's in your corner and is supportive, so you could just put it out there and put yourself out there and put that energy in the universe, and it will be attraction and not promotion, or it's just not going to happen.
Yeah. Well, what I've been thinking about it recently is that I'm trying to concentrate on the following that I do have in my family and among my close friends. And I have to say that I've been extremely fortunate to have people that come to see me time and time again. You know, Mama Judy comes to almost every performance. Mm-hmm. And I have other family members and other friends who, you know, come to see me perform. And I think I'm just going to have to probably let this one go.
You got, I really think that you got to let it go, because you're not going to be able to force, allegedly, your brother to...
Wasn't my brother.
...to come. All right, so I like to do a segment. This is the final segment of the podcast.
Okay.
You know, and you know, the time just does fly by. But there's what I like to call the quick eight. And
all right.
So there's going to be a series of eight quick-fire questions. You just let me know.
Are they going to be graded?
Yeah, there is a test at the end.
Okay.
You just let me know what word or what phrase first comes to mind when I ask you these questions. So, what is the job that you would love to have?
I would love to have your job.
This job?
Yes. I think I want to be an interviewer. I think I just decided that that's the job I want.
Really? Oh, wow.
Yes. I want to replace you.
Replace me already? Well, the only way that anybody would be able to replace me is if they find someone else named Tom Ragu, because the name of the thing is the Tom Ragu Sit-Down Comedy Show.
Right, but I can always legally change my name.
That's right. I didn't think of the whole legal thing.
Right.
And you're like a lawyer and smart and shit. Okay.
Okay.
What's your favorite curse word?
The F word.
The F word. Nobody likes to say the word. Okay.
Fuck.
What's your favorite sandwich?
Oh... Pastrami on rye with mustard.
Mm-hmm.
End of story.
End of story. No pickle, no Russian sauce.
Absolutely not.
No, it's good. It's good. What was your first concert that you went to?
Loggins and Messina.
That's great.
Do you know who they are?
Yeah, Kenny Loggins and...
Jim Messina.
Jim Messina, right. Of course I know. I'm a music person.
They sang the song about Christopher Robin and Pooh.
What's your biggest regret?
Going to law school.
Really? Wow. That's
yes.
That's substantial.
That is substantial.
That was.
Although, if I hadn't become a lawyer, I don't know how I would have supported myself. And my mother did say to me that it was important for me to find something in which I could support myself. In the event that I didn't find someone who could support me.
And then you would have never been in the Comedians at Law troupe.
Right.
And then you would have had that wonderful show at the White Plains.
Right. So I'm really, really glad I went to law school.
Right.
Yes.
I'm glad you went to law school, too.
Thank you.
Who is your free pass? Now, do we know what a free pass is?
Yes.
Okay. So who is your free pass?
Tina Fey.
Tina Fey.
Yes.
So have you ever dipped into the lady pond?
I have not, but that doesn't mean I don't think about it a lot.
What's your favorite recipe?
I don't like to cook. Would it have to be something that I cook?
No, it could be your favorite recipe on the Chew or whatever.
Oh, I love the Chew.
Yeah. You know, I put something on the Chew's website.
No.
I think I made my homemade chicken soup. Right?
Did they accept it?
They accept it. It's on the website. I think you can Google it and it comes up. And I put one of the ingredients as love.
Yes.
Because I do think that it is an ingredient in the chicken soup.
Absolutely.
And it's on there.
I would say I make a mean bolognese.
Oh, that's great. That's one of my favorites. And what's your guilty pleasure?
My guilty pleasure, eating as much cheese as I want.
That's great. Me too. And I
don't
think...
Don't you just love cheese?
I love cheese and The Real Housewives of Atlanta.
Oh, I've never seen a reality show.
No? Never seen a reality show?
No.
Do you have a TV?
I do. I have a TV, but I've never seen a reality
show.
Well,
consider yourself very lucky because...
Is it an addiction?
It can be addictive in nature, but I think that you have to have that thing inside of you that becomes easily addicted.
Uh-huh.
Like, I have known people that they see a couple of these shows and they're like, there's nothing happens.
Sort of like Facebook.
Right.
Yes. That's my addiction.
Right. Or Twitter.
Right.
So I want to thank you so much for joining us. I had such a fun time talking with you.
Thank you. I really enjoyed being here. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. Now, you can learn more about Joan Weisblatt by visiting her website, joanweisblattcomedy.com.
Correct.
And you're also on the comediansatlaw.com website.
That's right.
And you have a blog or page on there.
Every Thursday, in fact, today.
Right. And you're on Twitter as well, right?
Yes.
And so what's your Twitter handle?
It's very, very unusual. Joan Weisblatt.
Okay, so you can find at Joan Weisblatt on Twitter. My name is Tom Ragoo, and you can learn more about the podcast and previous podcasts that we have had at tomragoo.com/podcast. Thanks a lot, everyone, for tuning in, and have a great night, everybody.
Bye.